Tonight on All Things Considered, we begin a six-part series on plutonium, the mysterious story of the Kerr-McGee Plutonium Production Facility in Crescent, Oklahoma, and a plutonium laboratory analyst at that plant, 28-year-old Karen Silkwood. The series of investigative reports is the work of NPR's Barbara Newman. Barbara, let's do a little bit of setting up before we begin to hear this very dramatic series. What is plutonium?
Plutonium is a man-made element. It's the result of uranium fission in a nuclear reactor. It's among the most toxic substances known to man. The former director of the National Cancer Institute said that plutonium is the most potent respiratory carcinogen known to man. A very small amount, just the size of a grain of pollen, can cause lung cancer. It also has another property.
Yeah.
It's the substance of nuclear bombs. Just a handful, amount of size of an apple, can be used to fashion a nuclear device. So it's very important to safeguard worker health and safety dealing with it from cancer, and also safeguarding plutonium stocks from diversion by smugglers.
But isn't there also talk of using plutonium possibly as a fuel for nuclear reactors?
That's right. The Atomic Energy Commission last January proposed that plutonium be generally licensed as a commercial reactor fuel in present light water reactors. Currently, it is not licensed as a reactor fuel, and the plutonium that we're talking about, the plutonium fuel, is experimental fuel for the upcoming fast breeder reactors.
In other words, certain decisions about plutonium are going to have to be made here in the near future.
That's right, and that's why this story is so important, because if we look at Kerr-McGee, which is the precursor of the plutonium age, and we see how industry and the regulator now deal with plutonium, we can get an idea as to how effective it would be if it were generally licensed.
Now, this is a complicated story. Silkwood was a member of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union. She was worried about possibility of plutonium contamination at the Kerr-McGee plant, and then she died in a mysterious car accident. You're going to give us the details of all of this as the series progresses, but I wonder what the overall significance of it is beyond the Silkwood case, which, as we said, is a dramatic one.
Karen Silkwood was blowing the whistle on Kerr-McGee and on the regulator. She was saying that workers were not protected in terms of health and safety. She was also alleging that Kerr-McGee was producing faulty plutonium fuel, and employees at the company were falsifying official quality control records to hide that up. Now, her allegations in these areas were largely substantiated after her death by the Atomic Energy Commission. So if you look at the story, the importance of it is the questions that she raised regarding the safe management of plutonium.
Let's look at this story. Here now, part one of Barbara Newman's series.
Karen Silkwood was mysteriously contaminated by plutonium just 8 days before she died. And the Atomic Energy Commission, in its public reports, never established the circumstances of her contamination. It did establish, however, that plutonium was taken out of the Kerr-McGee plant and that Silkwood's apartment was seriously contaminated. There's another mystery. Was the car crash in which Silkwood was killed the result of an accident, or was it foul play? First, the medical examiner of the state of Oklahoma, Dr. A.J. Chapman.
It was our conclusion from the toxicological studies is that she was likely under the influence of a sedative hypnotic drug, in this case, namely methaqualone, and that all of the other evidence in the case gathered by the Oklahoma Highway Patrol did not indicate to us that any other vehicle was involved. And so it was our conclusion that the manner of death in this case was accident, and the death was so certified.
While the Oklahoma State authorities ruled the death accidental, A.O. Pipkin, a professional accident investigator hired by the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, thinks otherwise.
It's my opinion that there's enough circumstantial evidence present to indicate that V1, which is Miss Silkwood's car, was struck from the rear by an unknown vehicle causing it to go out of control due to either the initial impact or the combined impact and driver overreaction. I do not believe that the accident was caused by Karen Silkwood falling asleep at the wheel and the car just going off the road by itself.
The reason why it's so important to ascertain how Karen Silkwood died, aside from the personal tragedy of the accident, is that at the time of her death, she was on her way to a meeting with a New York Times reporter and a union official to present documentary evidence to support allegations she was making that quality control and other records were being falsified at Kerr-McGee. A file folder, which several people saw in her possession just several minutes before she died in the car crash, has never been found. Those who espouse the murder theory use Silkwood's activities in quality control as a possible motive. Falsification of government quality control records is a felony, with a penalty of 5 years in prison and a $10,000 fine. Contributing to the uncertainty about the car crash is a debate over the significance of the level of the drug methaqualone found in Silkwood's blood at the autopsy. Methaqualone is a widely used sedative which also has hypnotic properties. The level of methaqualone found in Silkwood's blood was 0.35 milligrams percent. Dr. Chapman interpreted this level to mean that Silkwood was under the drug's influence and that this was a contributory cause of her death, which the Highway Patrol then ruled an accident. Several other pharmaceutical sources NPR contacted disagreed with Chapman's interpretation of the effect of this level of methaqualone. They told us that 0.35 milligrams percent is a lower than therapeutic level and by itself would not impair driving. The Oklahoma Highway Patrol, stung by the national publicity of the Silkwood affair and Pipkin's analysis, reinvestigated the accident. Lieutenant Larry Owen, the patrol's top accident specialist, headed the reinvestigation.
From the standpoint of physical evidence, there's nothing to indicate there was ever a second vehicle involved in the accident. The theory of how she ran off the road could have been induced just as easily or could have been substantiated just as easily if she had just simply fallen asleep from fatigue. That's been substantiated by two witnesses we talked to. She was in no condition to drive the car when she left the restaurant.
Gerald Brewer is one of those witnesses that the Highway Patrol says told them that Silkwood was in no condition to drive the evening of her death. When I visited Oklahoma, he denied ever making the statement. Gene Young, along with Brewer, was one of the last people to see Silkwood alive. Young was also present at the union meeting at the Hub Cafe in Crescent, Oklahoma, which Silkwood attended just 20 minutes before she died, and here's what she thought of Silkwood's condition.
Well, to me, she was alert, you know, to drive. She could talk fine, she could walk straight.
Aside from the controversy of the significance of the drug level in Silkwood's blood, is the undeniable presence of a freshly made dent found in the left rear fender of Silkwood's car. This dent and several other pieces of evidence form the basis for Pipkin's theory that Silkwood's car was forced off the road by another vehicle.
The dent in the left rear fender, the dent in the bumper on the left rear corner, the path that the car took through the grass to the wing wall of the culvert, and the fact that the steering wheel was broken off equally on both sides of the steering column, and the position it would have to be broke off if your hands were gripped firmly on the steering wheel.
In other words, what you're saying is that she was gripping the steering wheel firmly, which is not the type of mode one would hold it in if one were under the influence of a drug, where one would tend to hold it very loosely.
That's right. And not only that, but if she just drove off the left side of the road, either dozing or under the influence of drugs or alcohol, without any control over the car would have never reached the concrete culvert in the first place. It went off farther to the east of the road and out to a pasture.
What Pipkin is talking about is that the embankment on which Silkwood's car was found sloped uphill. He found evidence that she was holding the steering wheel firmly and steering the car against the slope up the hill, trying to get it back on the road. Had she not been attempting to get back on the road, the car would have naturally tended to go into a pasture, totally missing the concrete wing wall, the impact with which killed her. I asked Lieutenant Kenneth Van Hoy, the director of public information for the Highway Patrol, to explain how Silkwood could have been gripping the steering wheel firmly if she were under the influence of a sleep-inducing drug. His theory...
Okay, she struck the north wing wall before her vehicle became airborne and before it struck the south wing wall. The shoulder is not as smooth as the roadway, and there's a possibility that she was aroused by the impact with the north wing wall, or at any rate, shortly before her final impact. And if it's possible that she woke up and was attempting to stop the vehicle by holding onto the steering wheel, if for no other reason.
You also said that you thought that the wrecker driver made the dent on the Silkwood car when they were towing the car away, that it hit a concrete wing wall.
Mm-hmm. We have evidence to indicate that this is what happened. The black from the tire is still on the south wing wall. We found paint scrapings on the east end of the south wing wall. The fender was fender damage is consistent with that produced by friction against a substance such as concrete wing wall in this case.
Have you all taken the dent in the rear fender and analyzed it for metal or paint scrapings from another vehicle?
We haven't, no. We have no laboratory facilities as such.
While Lieutenant Van Hoy says that the wrecker inflicted the dent on the Silkwood vehicle after the accident, the wrecker, Ted Sebring, says otherwise.
I didn't see us do it, no. I was looking back. I was looking at the car at all times when I was pulling it out.
Well, how could, if you didn't see you do it and you were there, how could it have been done?
I say I didn't do it. That's the only thing is that I don't believe that we dented it in the rear of the car.
Pipkin and a metallurgist analyzed the Silkwood dent under a microscope and say they found no evidence of concrete, such as would have been present had the dent been made by the car scraping against the concrete wing wall, as the Oklahoma authorities suggest. Actually, Pipkin claims to have found metal fragments possibly from another vehicle. Because the existence of the dent is so crucial to the Pipkin thesis that Silkwood was hit from behind by another vehicle, I asked Lieutenant Owen why the State Highway Patrol has never subjected the dent to its own laboratory analysis.
The fact that we did not have availability of the car after it was released from the authority of her father.
But you could have asked for it. You never did.
We checked to try to find where it was. We could not locate it in either Crescent, Edmond, or Oklahoma City.
Are you saying that the investigative work of the Oklahoma State Highway Patrol couldn't find this car that I, a reporter from Washington, D.C., could find?
We should have kept the car in our custody, but that's strictly in hindsight.
But you could probably still even get the car right now.
Yes, but from the standpoint, if two parties have scrapings, surely one of them is going to give us the information, or at least release the information to the press at some point on what they found.
You wouldn't think you ought to do your own?
Well, at this point, you know, in time, I'm not really sure, you know, 2 months hence, what good that would come if we would make further scrapings, especially if the Bureau has evidence that was collected fairly close to the time the accident happened.
The Bureau that Lieutenant Owen speaks of is, of course, the FBI. A National Public Radio has been told by an agent of the FBI that the FBI has not and will not subject the dent from Silkwood's car to a laboratory analysis. The reason given is that the FBI feels that the evidence is tainted because the Oklahoma State Highway Patrol did not maintain possession of the car following the accident. These essential questions apparently must remain unresolved. Did Karen Silkwood fall asleep, or did she lose control of her car under the influence of a drug? Was she forced off the road by another vehicle? Was she in control of her car and fighting to get it back on the road when she hit the concrete culvert that ended her life?
Barbara Newman. Tomorrow she'll look at charges regarding quality control at the Kerr-McGee plant. Karen Silkwood had planned to give evidence about quality control procedures to a New York Times reporter the night she died.